So two questions for our listeners today as we enter 2025. Are you concerned about your career path in a technology industry that is getting upended by AI? Have you ever considered engaging a professional to help guide you through career choices? Well, if you answered yes to one or both of those questions, this is the episode for you. I'm Thomas Law, the Executive Director of the Technology and Services Industry Association, and welcome to Tectonic, the podcast where we explore what makes technology business models successful in today's world. And today I'm going to be joined by Mary Kay Costin. She is a partner at High Point Advisors, which is a firm that provides coaching and advisory services to professionals. And we're going to get this insight engine humming here right away. Mary Kay, it's good to see you. I haven't seen you for a little while. And we've known each other for a long time. And you were just a fantastic member of the TSI community when you were at EMC and Dell. But you know, most folks don't know you as well as I do. So can you just kind of introduce yourself and describe your career path to folks out there?
Yeah, thanks for having me, Thomas. Actually, I believe that we met in, I don't know, like late 2007, 8, maybe somewhere in there when I worked for some microsystems. I think you were
in
the TSIA community. Well,
I knew you worked there, but I didn't realize that we actually met then. Man, that we're really good.
Yeah, it was a long time ago. Yeah. So to your question, my first job in high tech was actually with Sun Microsystems. I had been in the aerospace industry for years, and I was doing, sounds really fun, the displays for the cockpit of the F-A-18 aircraft. Oh, wow. So okay. I was the supply chain manager for displays, and I'm living in the Bay Area. It's, you know, the mid-90s, and I'm in the aerospace industry. What the heck am I doing? So I went to Sun Microsystems, and my first job in services and high tech was the commodity manager, the supply manager for the repair loop for the displays from the workstations at Sun.
Oh, okay, interesting. Yeah.
So that's how I started in high tech and services. And from there at Sun, I did many different jobs, logistics and portfolio and backline tech support and the field. And I did a lot of different roles. And by the time I left after the Oracle acquisition, I was doing all of the support role.
Oh, okay. And that was a great time to be in the 90s at Sun. That was a great ride because that's when, I mean, it was just booming growth, which created a lot of career opportunities to try different things. And they'd be like, hey, can you do, I remember those days. I was part of that, but I was competing against you when I was at SGI.
So. Oh, that's right. You were at SGI. That's right.
You guys did a better job. You won that war, I'll tell you.
Yeah. And then after the Oracle acquisition, I went to EMC. And I actually started in a field role, like the global field services. So I made a decision to make a change and to lose some scope. You know, sometimes that's the right thing to do. And and then over the years, I picked up all of the functions of support. And then there was the Dell acquisition. And I had that same role for a little while. But then as things changed with that, I moved to the role that I had up until I left this year, which was the operations role. And in that role, operations in the sense of anything that wasn't kind of line customer facing delivery for, you know, the services team and, you know, Doug Schmidt's organization. I know, you know, Doug, whether it's online support, the data science, AI models, the customer experience, it was like 100 different things in that job.
Well, one thing that really impressed me watching you through your career is when that EMC Dell merger occurred, and anybody who's lived through a merger of that size, I mean, there's a lot of complexity, there's a lot of angst, and it's kind of tough sometimes to make it through, especially in a sense when you were at EMC and you were being acquired. There was, you know, the merger. Mm-hmm. So Dell was a big company. And it's to navigate that. And you not only navigated it, but you really thrived through that merger. So that was pretty amazing to watch. So it was really cool. So I wanted to open up here. And, you know, before we talk about your current role, I want to talk about, you know, sort of what has shaped you to date and the career experiences. And you already mentioned a really interesting thing about when you changed to EMC and you changed scope and you took, you know, a smaller scope. One of the very first podcasts we did was with Dion Hedgepath. We talked about what we called spiral career paths. You know, you're growing in one area, you're getting more and more responsibility. And then instead of staying in that area, you jump over to a different area. And often you make, you know, like you said, could you go down in scope, take a smaller role, if you will, but it's an opportunity to grow in different areas. And that is a very powerful way to round out, you know, your expertise and to create long-term growth. But I'm super curious, what are some of the big experiences that have shaped you up to this point?
Yeah, what did they say? Think of your career as a lattice, not a ladder. I don't know who said that, but I think that's great advice. But a couple of times in my career, I would say things didn't happen the way I thought they were going to happen. It wasn't what I intended to happen next or what I had hoped to happen next. And sometimes that's because of circumstances that were within my control and something I should have done a better job with, or sometimes they're completely out of your control, yeah. You know? And it takes a lot of resilience and things to get through that. And, you know, when you were talking a minute ago, I was thinking about the Jack Kerouac quote, you know, there's nowhere to go, but still everywhere, and you keep rolling through the stars or something like that. And I think when things are crazy and things aren't going your way, the more positive thinking, not like, oh God, you know, everybody's stupid and they don't know. And, you know, why are they doing that? And why did this affect me? You know, just to be like, how can I make this a good thing for the business and for me? Just be positive. And so there are some times, you know, back to things that shaped me, where things did not go the way I wanted them to go. And I just kept positive and went from there. You know, there's a lot of leaders that have influenced me, and some of them you know well, Doug Schmidt, Kevin Roche, Howard Elias. Don't know if you remember from Sun, Ian White. But my story goes, and whenever people ask me this question, this story always comes to my mind because I remember it like it was yesterday. Back to being resilient and things change. I was in an individual contributor role. I had been a director, but the victim, and I don't mean to use that word very negatively, but I was the, you know, impacted by spans and layers, and my job was eliminated. I got this wow project as an IC. And so I remember when it happened, I'm like, don't think about losing your director role, right? Thinking about your wow project and all the things that this could bring to you. So back to Ian, he was the sponsor of this project. And we were sitting in a conference room, and like I said, vividly remember this like it was yesterday. And we were talking about something, and I was trying to influence him to change his mind about something. And he said to me, he got very frustrated because, you know, he was like, okay, you're right. You know, like, let's move on. And he goes, and by the way, you're going to run services someday. Mm. And I'm like, okay, you know, I just lost my director's job. I'm not really thinking about running services someday, but, you know, thank you. And we talked about it, but kind of fast forwarding after that project was over, I got back and doing some line jobs and things. Ian was running EMEA at the time. A couple years later, he comes back to run the Americas. Mm-hmm. And he pulled me over to do the call center role. I didn't know anything about the call center at the time. I had been doing some backline technical support stuff. And just long story short, over the next 6 years, I worked for Ian, and I probably did six different roles, mostly at the vice president level. He put me in jobs I had no idea how to do. And when you put me in charge of the field role of North America, the people that were going to be working for me were all men that had their whole careers in the field.
In that area,
I was so nervous. And you know, that's a hard thing to step into.
Yeah.
So I feel like what I always took away from that is a couple of things. When you see potential in people, call it out, and they may not see it. And we all have that bit of imposter syndrome or I'm not good enough kind of thing going on in your head. So call it out. And then help people get breadth in their career. And just a plug for TSIA, just to wrap up the Ian story. Let's see, I think it was in the North America role. Ian really wanted one of those JD Powers, and I'm going to get wrong. Yeah. Help me, Thomas, the certified, your certification and, you know, support. And So I led the team to go get the certification. And I'll never forget, like, I called him. I said, Ian, you know, I just want to say we won. We achieved it. We got the JD Power thing. And he was like, I could kiss you. And I'm like, and you know, Ian's like this Scottish man. And, you know, he's very, and he's like, I'm like, I'm so glad we're on the phone. But nice. So I just, lots of people influence you, but, you know, people that really have confidence in you. And
yeah, I mean, and I think there's a lot of important things you pointed out there. And again, when I was asking you what's shaped your career, it's interesting that you gravitated to instances where there is a short-term setback, right?
Yeah.
Those are probably, I think people have a tendency to get frustrated because they always think it's up and to the right. You know, I just want more people, more responsibility, bigger title. Yeah. You know, it's just up and to the right. And I, in my own career, I've not found that to be true. And some of the most successful people I've ever interacted with, that's not true. And you said another important thing, which was, hey, let me lean into this wow opportunity. Stop worrying about what changed and what went away. And let's focus on the task at hand. And I think that's what Ian probably was responding to and recognized. Because, you know, you have a lot of people working for you like he did. And you're probably on a day-to-day basis, that's not what he's dealing with. He's dealing with people who are like, oh, who moved my cheese? And why does this have to change? You know, right? They're all complaining, right? They're all frustrated. And then, you know, you see somebody who's like, hey, I'll make the move. I'll throw myself into this new thing. And that's, I think, you know, it is more rare to see that. And that's, you know, into the other important thing you said is, you know, if you have employees that are working for you and you see those types of sparks, recognize it, call it out, you know, acknowledge it so that they know that that is appreciated and that that is a great attribute to have, and especially tech. I mean, the other thing is, you know, and you've been through it in all these different companies you've worked for, tech is constantly changing. So it's not an industry to sit down like you joined a law firm, you know, you join whatever, and you're like, I'm just going to work my way and everything's pretty much the same. And I mean, that's not the industry we're in. So if you're not comfortable with making those kind of lateral moves, spiral moves, jumping into different things, you're probably in the wrong industry. I mean, this is just, you know, that's just the nature of the...
Would not agree more.
Yeah, nature of the beast, for sure. You have been very successful here. And I am curious... I've watched you through these companies. Now you decide to do this new thing and do a second career as an executive coach. So what inspired you to make that different move, that spiral career move?
I see it less of a career move than just the next phase. What's the next phase? And I, you know, I've been working for 40 years and I was fortunate to be able to retire. But I wasn't ready to retire.
Yeah.
I needed to change to give me a little bit of more freedom. I wanted to do things that I wouldn't be able to do 5 years from now. You know, I want to hike the Camino. I want to do the Appalachian Trail before my hips and my knees give out. So if I need to be off, I can't be off the grid working like we were just talking about it. It's hard to unplug for a day.
Yeah.
So planning to... let's say retire, you know, leave Dell, and talking to Doug, my leader, about that over the years, about when that would be. And so I could see it being ready. I could see myself mentally being ready to leave, but not to be done. And so back to what inspired me, I was actually talking to somebody that was working for me. And she said, you know, you would be a great coach. And I thought to myself, how come I never thought of that? Like, you know, why didn't I didn't say to her like, oh yeah, that's a great idea. I'm going to go work on that right now. But that's literally what I did. I thought, okay, I know coaches, you know, Lisa Mink was a coach I have a lot of respect for. And I was like, I could do what Lisa does. Not like as well as she does, but I could do that, you know? And so I started looking into it and pursued it. And that's kind of how I got here. I thought I could keep the best part of my jobs. You know, I've always loved inspiring and working with people to be their best. And I get to do that now full time. Well, not, I don't work full time, right? Yeah. I'm still trying to enjoy some of my flexibility of retirement, you know? So I work when I'm to what my clients need and I work to the demand. And then sometimes I don't work at all.
Well, you know, to that point, and again, based on the industry that you work in, I mean, tech is a pretty high-paced industry, and like you said, one, it's very difficult to unplug from when you're in it, and especially like yourself, you had operational roles. I mean, you are in it day in and day out. And so I think there's a lot of people that come to that juncture in their career where they're like, I want to keep doing something, but I don't want to keep doing this day-to-day that I've been doing, right? I want to make that change. And I think the two things that they look for is exactly what you said. I think they look for more flexibility. So I don't have to be, you know, full-time, and I just have more flexibility, maybe on location, all kind of things. And then also just to find something that they have some passion around, they feel that they have some unique skills around, and in your case, coaching. And so I think there's a lot of people, especially our age, that is a very common juncture, but it's not, I'll put one more thing on the table, it's not an easy one, because yeah. It's what I see in peers, friends, you know, who face this. It's, well, number one, am I sort of brave enough to make the change? Because autopilot's kind of easy, right? And you have your income coming in, you have your all that stuff coming in. And then the second big question is, but what would the other thing be? Mm-hmm. And it takes work to figure that out. And sort of the autopilot and inertia, I think, keeps some people in their traditional role, I'm going to say, you know, several years more than they probably should have done. It's just like, yeah. You know, take the break. Don't wait till you're 65. Don't wait till you're whatever. You know, it's like, take a look at this, you know, earlier and find, you know, a different path for a while. I think it would be, and there's so many people that have a lot to offer by jumping on different paths. So it's interesting. So you get the flexibility, you pick coaching. So let's click into coaching, because that's really the main reason I wanted to get you on here to talk about this, because it's something I'm personally, you know, fascinated in. And I think, you know, right now, these tech business models, and we just, you know, I made the point that it's always been a fast-paced industry, but God, right now, the rate of change is even more intense. I mean, it's the way that, you know, AI is impacting everything, the way that just people are really rethinking the operation models. And this is, as you know, this is what we do for a living, benchmark and understand these operational models. And I just really see people nervous/excited about what these new models could be, but you can tell that there's going to be a lot of change. I don't, you know, I made this point on the stage before. It's like, I don't care what your job is, but your mantra in tech right now should be, you know, AI may not replace my job, but it's definitely going to change the way I'm working. And that's everybody. I don't care what, you know, where you are in the stack and, you know, the career ladder. And so from your experience right now, what are some of the challenges your clients are articulating to you in this current environment?
You know, you just said it. It seems so basic, but it is about pace. That is what they're all talking about. Nobody wants to be left behind. And we used to talk about pace 3 years ago, 2 years ago, 5 years ago. I can't believe how fast things are moving. And, you know, it's hard to keep up. And it's just, you laugh. You wish you could go back to those paces. It's just insane. Yeah. And so it is the single most thing that creates that underlying kind of anxiety and stress about, like, how can I keep up? How can I get this all done? How can I X? And I think my guidance generally is, like, you cannot control the pace. Don't try to control the pace. Things you can control, things you cannot control. You cannot control the pace of the company you work for and the things going on around you. And so, and this is where the experience kind of as a leader comes in. You know, what's unique about my partner, Chris Scolo, and I is we are coaches, but we have many years of experience in corporate world and tech in particular. And so I think about, like, okay, as a leader, what advice would I give them, and not just as a coach? Yeah. And when I put my leader hat on, my coach hat, when I'm working with them, is like, what is important to your leader and their leader? What are their priorities? And stay focused as much as you can on their priorities. I'm not saying ask your leader to prioritize your work. Gosh, no. But no, how are they being measured? What is their next review with their leader? And what is it about? And keep your eye on those things. Make sure that you've got those things covered. And then there's always this layer of things that you've got to do that your boss doesn't know anything about. Right. And that if you don't get those done, then your boss is going to be, your leader is going to be knowing about them because something goes wrong. Yep. So you have to just constantly be triaging what all these activities are and to work through those, or the pace will drive you crazy. Yep. And it will burn you out.
So there's a couple things I want to click into there. And the first one that you mentioned about understanding what your leader or your leader's leader cares about. I think it's fascinating how many people I can talk to in tech companies, even all the way up to the vice president level, but definitely at the director level, where if you ask that question, right, like what's super important to the company right now, or your executive team, or like you say, your direct leader, that they'll give you a kind of like a mushy answer, right? Like, oh, well, you know, they really care about growth. Okay, but growth where? And so I think that skill of having, and you also said another important thing, it's not going into your boss's office and saying, hey, you tell me what's important, right? And it should be a natural conversation where you're like, hey, I just want to really make sure, you know, I got my team focused and, you know, what's really important this fiscal year, you know, what's top of mind for, you know, the executive team. And being dialed into that is going to help you, because then you can align and prioritize, you know, your activities to support that. So I think that that's an interesting point of guidance, because I think there are a lot of people that are just sort of nose down, I got my task list, and they don't understand how it fits in to what senior leadership really cares about. And the more you understand that, I think the more successful you're going to be. But the other thing you said, you know, this pace will kill you. You know, you can't control the pace. And so the other one of my sayings, you know, within my own company, but to anybody, is I say, look, resources are finite, not infinite. And that's true in every company you ever work in, right? So how do you, you know, you help, I'm sure, coaching people to say, look, you cannot do 100 things. You don't have those many hours. Your team doesn't have that many hours. So it is, it's a lot about making choices. It's about, yeah. You know, and I think that's a tough thing. People get the anxiety because they don't, like, oh, gosh, I got to do it all. Well, there's just no way you're going to do it all. Yeah. And that's another tough one I think people have to come to terms with. So you're seeing just anxiety by pace. People are concerned about that. Talk a little bit about just clicking into AI specifically and how it's influencing leadership teams, decision-making. What are you hearing from your clients there in terms of just how they think it's going to impact their world?
Yeah, I don't have a single meeting where somebody doesn't bring up an AI project. You know, it's crazy. And I think part of it is just understanding how it's affecting, like you said, decision-making and the culture. Different leaders and different companies have different cultures, and, you know, different cultures and leaders have different love languages. You know, you walk into and you're making a presentation, you have to understand, are they a numbers person? Are they a concept brainstorming person? You know, yeah. Who are you engaging with? And I think what AI has changed is whatever that love language culture, you know, was, or it still is, the balance of it is absolutely changing. We always look at a combination of data and information and intuition, experience to make decisions. And I think we always will, but the balance of that is changing, and it's much more data driven at a much faster pace. So decision making, pace, back to pace, fast, you got to make decisions faster because you have to keep up with the pace. There's not time for a week to analyze something. The data is coming faster. You've got to just keep up with that. And so in that whole strategy and planning process, remember, you know, everybody's talking about these precious, scarce resources with AI. It's not like everybody's out there still competing for the same resources to have these projects come to fruition and to deliver an ROI. And it's just competing for that. You have to really learn how to influence those decisions with good data, quick POCs, and just show that value so you can just take it to scale. I think we can all do a POC, but then you got to scale it and hit the bottom line.
So what I hear there, and I want to click on two things. So the first one being sort of data and decision-making. So my working thesis right now is that management teams, executive teams are going to become way more data and model-driven than they've ever been. Because you've been in enough business decisions where, okay, we got a spreadsheet and yeah, we're kind of looking at these numbers, but then it's like, well, you know, what does our gut tell us here? I mean, you know, a lot of, you know, that's a lot of business has been made. But now if you are looking at models that are bringing insights that, you know, nobody around the management team even saw in the data, right, that you can't ignore, it changes behaviors there. So I think that people are going to be much more data driven, and you're right, it's going to accelerate the speed of decisions. And also the other thing you said is, you know, this concept of proof of concepts, you know, once we see opportunities, we got to jump on them fast in terms of, hey, the data is showing us this. Let's make a decision. Let's put some resource over there. Let's get a proof of concept. Is there there? Yes or no? And we got to jump on it. It's sort of a different pace, but also a different decision-making process.
Well, and I just something that you said, just kind of another thing I feel like is that historically, like you said, spreadsheets and kind of static data and stuff.
Yeah.
We as leaders would look for static kind of spreadsheet kind of data that would affirm our intuition experience, right? So, and that is, you know, with the way AI can be so much more dynamic, I don't think that's as prevalent as more. I think, you know, you see kind of that opening of the aperture in people's minds about like, oh, I didn't know things you didn't know, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, let me give you a classic example. I mean, the first area that I started to consultant when I left SGI was around professional services. And I would help companies specifically on sort of building the business model for their embedded PS. And everybody had a spreadsheet, as you can imagine, that showed revenue and costs and margins. And
utilization.
And by the way, they all went up to the right in a straight line. They just all went, every year just got better and better and better. Here's our five-year plan. And at the end, we're making, you know, this amount of money. And I would say, look, that doesn't map to reality. That's not the way these businesses scale. And nobody wanted to hear it, right? Nobody wanted to hear it. And so I think in the world of AI, you could say, hey, let's put that into an AI model that models project-based businesses, blah, blah, blah. And if the model starts telling you it's not all up and to the right in the curve, you know, then I think management teams are going to get to a place where they realize I can't ignore that. I can't make business decisions based on what I wish is going to happen or based on, you know, the static spreadsheet. I've got to make decisions based on the best analytics, the best data possible. And I think for the management teams that ignore that capability, that's, you know, that's going to be no bueno. I think they're, you know, those businesses are going to be struggling for sure. And so I want to click into when you actually work with some of your clients, are there any particular methodologies, frameworks you use to help them set their priorities, get aligned with what they're doing? How do you approach that?
So I received my coaching, you know, to be a coach, you should be certified. It's not as easy as people think it is, right? Yeah. And I got my certification through IPEC. It's an International Coaching Federation certified program. Okay. And what's unique about that program is it has this whole aspect you spend, gosh, I think it was probably 20 hours on, called energy leadership. And so before I describe what that is, because it sounds a little metaphysical, and I don't want people to think like I move to the desert and I sit in the desert like in drum circles with crystals in my pocket, which I have done, and I don't knock until you've tried it. But I think just simply like, I think we'd all prefer to be around people that bring positive energy to whatever, a meeting, a dinner party, you know, or something like that. I think we've all gone to a dinner where we want to get there early to make sure we sat next to the people that are going to like bring energy to the conversation, not the person that's going to drag the energy and suck the life out of a room. And so what this model is, so now that I have you thinking, don't think I'm off my rocker when I talk about energy, this model has like seven layers of energy. And it's all about thinking about your thoughts and your feelings and your actions and being aware and conscious of how thoughts drive feelings, drive actions. And so at the very kind of center of this is the lowest level energy. And it's this victim mentality, right? So if you approach everything from a victim mentality, like, of course that went wrong, things always go wrong for me, you know, and the very low level of catabolic energy, you're going to bring a different thought, feeling, and action into situations than if you're a kind of move to the middle. If you're one of those win-win kind of energies, you're very anabolic, you're collaborative, you're like, you're going to make the best of everything, we're going to get through this. We'd all want to work for those kind of people, not the people that are in the victim mentality. Yeah. So part of, back to kind of your question, some of the frameworks and methodologies, this kind of goes around many different things that I do. Like if I have a client that really hates their job, it's bringing them down, really bringing them down. Yeah. Their boss is stupid. Nobody knows what they're doing. The company is a mess, whatever it is, right? And I first need to kind of figure out what kind of energy are they really bringing to not just this situation, any situation. If they are a level one person or a level two person and they live in that energy of woe is me, it's just always happens to me, them changing roles or careers isn't going to change that, right? We first got to kind of get to that, get them up in their awareness and consciousness, and then we can figure out roles and career changes and things like that. So I do actually am very in tune now to what people say, trying to read thoughts and feelings behind actions, and then trying to, you know, like, why do you think that is? You know, well, you know, they just don't know what's going on. Okay, well, why do you think they don't know what's going on? They must be smart because they got this role somehow. Well, you know, well, their boss is really making them do this. Okay, well, why do you think that's important to their boss? Like, you know, it's trying to develop that empathy and trying to develop their abilities to understand what's really going on all around them, and just, you know, again, bring that energy level up, which then, again, when you have, it's like when I'm playing golf, if I think I'm going to make a shot, go out into the desert, it's likely, it's like every time I go in front of the water hole, you know, and I pull the found ball out of my bag because I don't want to lose a good ball. It's like, what am I?
That's a confidence.
Yes. Yeah. So it's like, what am I saying to myself? I'm saying to myself that that ball is going into the water. So stop, like, just, yeah, you know, suck up the $3 if the ball, yeah, goes in the water, and just, right, be confident, you know?
So, I mean, so you put a lot on the table there, and I want to click into a couple of things. And one, which I think is foundational, is what I hear there is that mental attitude, sort of approach, how they're going, you know, into it. If that's not sound, then it doesn't matter where you're working, because you're going to take that baggage from one job where you're frustrated, and the next thing you know, you'll be at the other job, you'll be just as frustrated, because they don't have the skills to build what you're talking about, is the empathy and understanding, say, hey, well, what, you know, why does my boss think that? Or why does my boss's boss think that? Or why are these decisions being made? In leaning into that, I think that is such sound advice, because I do get to spend time with a lot of professionals, and I do see some that are just highly, highly frustrated, and they're miserable. They're just miserable. Mm-hmm. I hear about it. Like, I'm not their coach. I'm sort of
just, you're a therapist.
You know, I'm the therapist that hears about it. Right? They're like, oh, Thomas, these people are so screwed up and blah, blah, blah. And I'm, you know, I do the best I can in those situations. But the reality is, I do think silently to myself, and I'm not in a position, this is not my role to tell them, you know, what you're telling them, which is, well, part of this is, and more than part of this is on you. You know, you can't just keep having this negative attitude about how everybody else is screwed up, right? That's not going to get you where you want to go. And we're not talking about like positive mental attitude. No, we're talking about a skill set to really be empathetic and inquisitive to understand, you know, what some of these other dynamics are. And the other thing I'll put on the table, this is something I believe very deeply. And that is, you know, I've told myself that for any person I'm ever working for, whatever employment I'm in, that the one feeling I have to have for that job is gratitude. I have to feel that I'm grateful for the opportunity. And the moment that that goes away, then I need to change jobs. If I really in my heart don't, mm-hmm, feel gratitude for the opportunity, that I feel like it's just, you know, I'm taken advantage of, this sucks, they don't get it, this is a waste of my time, you know, blah, blah. If I feel those things on a daily basis, I have to change my job.
I'm going to use that. That's great.
Yeah. And I think if more employees just thought about that, am I really grateful? And I'm not saying, oh my gosh, I'm just saying, yeah, just don't feel a certain level of gratitude, like I'm grateful for this opportunity, then you are probably in the wrong job.
And you don't have to be grateful every day.
No. Exactly. I'm like, oh my gosh.
There'll be days.
Yeah. I'm not talking about, all my bosses are so perfect and this job company is so wonderful. I'm not talking about that. I'm just talking about the fact that you feel like, hey, you know, all up and in on average here, you know, on a weekly, monthly, quarterly basis, I'm grateful for this particular opportunity. And, you know, I feel like I've got growth opportunities, I've got learning, I've got whatever. And if you don't feel that at some level, you were ran the wrong job. But I think, you know, that's tough. But I like that framing on the energy levels, because I think it's almost like if you don't start at that foundation of their own personal energy and perspective, you can't coach them on all the other stuff. You can't, mm-hmm, really get them to be making better priorities and better management decisions and everything else. So let me ask this question. So as you start to work with a client and you're applying this framing, how do you measure success?
Yeah, you know, a coach client relationship is a partnership. And so it's really, it's how they measure success. You know, are they, you know, I can think I'm inspiring them to be successful at something or to meet their goals, but I can only think. I don't really know, you know. And so it's really how they measure success. And one of the things unique, I mentioned it before about what we do, is coaching is different from mentoring. It's different from advising. And I can do any of those things. And sometimes I think somebody may just want me to tell them what they need to do. But I think I first got to coach them, back to the energy thing. I got to coach something, because it's not going to really help them if I just tell them what to do. It's kind of, you're co-creating this relationship and I'm trying to understand what they really want, but sometimes I don't give them what they want. I give them what they need. And so that's when I have to check in and say, is this working for you? Because, you know, I'm doing what I think is best for them sometimes, so that they can achieve things themselves without leaning on me.
Do you feel that as you watch a client over time, are you looking for markers? And I think in terms of, you know, somebody comes in and let's say they're very frustrated. Let's say they're very overwhelmed. Let's say they're very unsure. That's why they're, you know, there's like, I need some help on this, right? I'm reaching out to a coach. And then do you look for markers? I mean, to me, in things around like, hey, they have either less anxiety in general, more confidence, more, again, happiness, because they're like, hey, I do have some good opportunities. Can you see that unfold in a client over time? I'm just curious.
Yeah, absolutely. You see, it looks many, you know, you can seem more relaxed about something. They can seem less anxious about something. They can seem like, you know, I think it's back to that energy, you know, again, I don't mean to sound like I'm out in the drum circle, but you know, you see energy in people, and you see negative energy or catabolic energy, and you see anabolic energy. And when you see them come to a session and they're coming with anabolic energy when they typically come with catabolic energy, you can see that no matter what it's about, you know, something with their family, something with work. Absolutely, you see it.
Yeah. One of the interesting things about what you're doing for a living right now is that I think that a lot of professionals in their career, everybody talks about quote networking. And I want to network, I want to network, I want to meet people, I want to know a lot of people. But what they don't do is curate relationships that really can help mentor, coach, and advise them, you know, on a career level, right? They don't think about like, who are those people in my life that I could pick up the phone and call and say, hey, I'm debating this move, or I think so many professionals don't have a good Rolodex there. I see that. And when I have personally seen professionals, there was an executive I worked with at Silicon Graphics, Ken Coleman. And I'm telling you, man, this guy was a black belt in building relationships, meaningful relationships, people that he could talk to. And then he in kind was a fantastic, you know, mentor and coach and stuff. And so, you know, some people, it's just they are really good at that. But I think most of us, because we're too busy, because we're through this, and we don't know how to do it, how to build that type of personal relationship. So I think, you know, what's interesting for what you do for a living is, you know, you are a bridge there for people that haven't developed this muscle. It's like, hey, I do need this kind of relationship of somebody that can give me an outside perspective, that really can, again, coach, mentor, advise me, that it can be a sounding board. And I think that's an important, I think everybody needs that in their career, but so many people just don't develop it. They just don't develop, you know, those type of people, relationships in their lives.
Yeah. I'm impressed with, I have people reach out to me that I used to work with, and, you know, they say, oh, I know you're busy. You know, I'm thinking, I'm not as busy as you, but yeah, I mean, I'm busy. And they're like, you know, would you mind looking at my resume, or would you mind this? Would you mind that? And I kind of charge for this. It's like, yeah, of course. Like, I think if they took the time to reach out to me and ask me for something, you know, for help with something, I'm going to help them. I mean, that takes a lot sometimes. And then also it's just, they're keeping their network. A lot of people call me about jobs. Yeah. And so when I'm saying, I'm not going to go back into the corporate world, do you have ideas of who might be a good fit for that thing? And I think, you know.
I want to click into this trail here for a second, because I get that call a lot as well. And it'll be somebody who I've known, you know, professionally, or I know them from LinkedIn, and they're calling and saying, hey, you know, I'm looking. They want to have a job conversation. And I'm always happy to have the conversation. But I think that, again, the missed opportunity is, you know, calling the last minute saying, I'm looking for a job, is not the same as building this relationship over time with somebody. You know what I mean? Where again, you're having an ongoing relationship of, you know, a sounding board, somebody you can talk to. And again, that's where I see the dead spot. And I'll just put, you know, one thing on the table for people out there that I personally committed to is I've had employees work for me at TSIA and they will leave and they'll be earlier in their career. And I'll say, look, I commit to you. I will take a monthly call with you as long as you want to talk about anything you want to talk about and to basically help them build that muscle. And some people take you up on it and some don't. But the ones that do, it's really interesting how long those monthly calls will go on. You know, I mean, for years where people, you know, will do it and sometimes they make it, sometimes they can't make it. But now they have a truly relationship. They're not going to call me last minute and say, I'm looking for a job. We actually have a real relationship, right? And really know what's important to them, all that kind of stuff. And I just put that out there for people that are more senior in your career. That's something I think you can do to give back to the people that are younger and you help them build this type of muscle of having, you know, a better group of relationships to help you. So let me see. I want to give you just one final question here. It's the pop quiz here. So when you look back at your career in tech, what was the best career decision you ever made?
I think I'm going to go back to something that we talked about in 2005-ish to 2010. It wasn't great at Sun Microsystems. They were, you know, people were, you know, we were maybe going to be acquired, maybe not going to be acquired, and stock was going nowhere, and bonuses were thin, if non-existent. And I almost left to go to NetApp or eBay, you know, but what kept me, and it was almost like this last minute, like things before I would leave, is another executive would leave. And so back to, you know, Ian White, he'd be like, oh, go do the field or go do the call center. So I kept getting lateral and upward moves because people were leaving. And so it's like, well, I can't leave because I have this opportunity to learn something new, you know, and think about my resume and all this breadth of experience that I'm going to be able to put on my resume. And I was almost left right before the Oracle acquisition. Mm-hmm. And I decided to stay a little longer because it was a little bit interesting in the way that acquisition unfolded, but like all the due diligence was done after the announcement. So I thought, I got to stay. So I got to like stay to be a part of that. I was leading, you know, all of support at the time. So I will learn so much being part of an acquisition like that. Sure. And so I stayed till like just basically, you know, 6 months or so after it landed. And it's like, okay, now I need to go. I got to go work for another company and it's not Oracle. So I think best career decision was, hey, financially, I think it did work out for out of luck because of the Oracle acquisition and some things that came from that. But it was just the breadth of experience I could gain from just sticking it out with a company that was in flux at the time.
Well, I'll just build on that example you gave, because I have seen this time and time again. There are tons of opportunities when companies are in decline, which is a paradox. You know, when companies are facing headwinds, a lot of people go, oh, I got to jump onto the next new shiny penny. And especially in tech, people want to go like, who's hot right now? I got to go over there. Right. I got to go apply over there because that's where all the opportunity is going to be. But there are a lot of incredible lessons you can learn as a leader and as a manager when a company is facing headwinds. And then, but the second thing I'll put on the table, and you've probably seen this as well, and you timed it. You're like, okay, I had that experience at Sun. And then I knew after the acquisition was you know, done, it was time to go. And the other problem people have is they don't know when it's time to go. they stay too long because they're too comfortable, right? They're just like, well, I've been here X amount of years. So, you know, it is a sweet spot. It is, you know, don't jump too soon, but don't stay too long.
And I ask people sometimes when we're having that conversation, you know, should I stay or should I go, right? Is think about 5 years from now, you're still there. How likely would it be for you to leave at that point?
Yeah.
And if they say, I would not leave, okay, then picture your entire career at company X. Are you okay with that? Yeah, as long as I'm grateful or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
So I have to think about it. I wouldn't have got the job at EMC had I not stayed and done all those different things.
Yeah. And EMC was apparently crazy. So I'm sure that's right there was super helpful.
I can't even count as many acquisitions and then being on the other side of another big acquisition with Dell. So I've been very lucky in my career. And I've loved every minute. I've been grateful for, you know, not every day, but I've been grateful throughout my career. Yeah.
Well, it's fantastic catching up with you. I enjoy the time and I wish you luck in the new endeavor here. And I always end these podcasts with a question of the day. And the audience here, are you prepared to successfully navigate the next phase of your career? Cheers, everybody.